Morning, I'm Joe McGill and you're listening to the Saturday Supplement, and I hope I find you well wherever you are listening to us around the world on RadioKerry.ie, on the Radio Kerry app or on the traditional wireless 96 to 98 FM. I hope you've enjoyed the fine weather all week as well. It is great to have it, and I hope you're enjoying your holidays if you're off at the moment. Many people take holidays, so I hope you're enjoying all of that. We have a very busy programme as always on the Saturday Supplement. Very soon I'll be talking to people involved in a wonderful fundraiser for palliative care hospice in Tralee, and it's a big night taking place in Ballybunion, and there's lots involved in it, and we'll be talking about that very shortly. We'll also be hearing from Thomas O'Sullivan, author, poet, historian, about another Tommy O'Sullivan, the Grotto Builder, and fascinating to hear about a man that dedicated his free time to building grottos in honour of his mother. So it's a great story, so you're going to want to stay tuned for that. And an interview I did over 5 years ago in January in 2020, just before COVID, with Mick McGillicuddy from Over the Water about his life as a fisherman. Mick passed away a few months after that interview, and this is the first time we're going to play it for you. Fascinating story about life as a fisherman, and a challenging life and a rewarding life as well, though. So we're going to be hearing that as well. But first, My Van are having another parish fundraiser, and they're presenting a Christmas-themed candlelight evening with Frank McNamara and special guests, including Tomás O'Shea, Anne Phelan, Megan and Megan Ruby Walsh. It's taking place Sunday the 30th of November, and it's taking place in the Tin Tawn Ballybunion in Kerry, that wonderful venue there. And to tell us more all about this, I'm delighted to say in studio again, she's no stranger to this programme, Mairead Hanlon, we've Father Brendan Walsh, we've Elaine Foley and Danny O'Sullivan. You're all very welcome.
Thanks very much, Joe.
So, Mairead, you're a glutton for punishment. You're always involved in some fundraiser or other. Tell us about the last one that's just gone. How did that go?
The last one was a huge success. We had Michael English at a concert in My Van. Absolutely amazing night. Beautiful spiritual concert. People were moved, so moved emotionally that night with his performance. It was a really spiritual occasion. Everybody enjoyed it. And we raised a lot of money for Axel Horgan, so we raised almost 23,000 for him, which was fantastic. And yeah, so it kind of gave us a new excitement with the concert in My Van, and we decided that we would have a second one. So that's coming up on the 30th of November, and the charity we chose this time is Palliative Care-Hospice here in Tralee, an amazing charity, do amazing work inside in Tralee, and you know, unfortunately cancer has touched many, many lives. Nearly every family would have had an experience, unfortunately, of cancer in some shape or form. And you know, I know myself firsthand from people working there as well, that what they do, they go above and beyond the call of duty inside the staff. It's an amazing environment to work in. Our two kids did some of their nursing training there, and they said like that the atmosphere inside is totally the opposite to what you would think of a palliative care situation. There's a wonderful atmosphere inside, great positivity, great joy, great fun, and definitely the staff in there, it's a vocation, really. Apart from any other of the nursing departments, I think it's definitely a vocation to nurse in palliative care.
Yeah, and then there's people, sometimes it's kind of full and people can't get in there, which is a tragedy as well, and that's why they're trying to fundraise, is to come up with these other rooms. Mm-hmm. And the money they have to raise is astronomical, really, and they have to kind of do it all themselves, so that's mm-hmm. why fundraisers like this are
the
vital.
The cost of the new project, the new build, they're building on 5 rooms, that'll bring their total capacity then to 20. I mean, I think they could do with double that, mm-hmm. but funds won't allow it, so to build the 5 rooms, facilities for children as well, they're taking that into account, and also families. So it's actually more than the five bedrooms. So the total cost of the project is 6 million. So the day that we met Mary Shanahan, Father Brendan and myself, we actually failed to get parking at the back of the hospital. Such was the amount of cars and the people in there, both for the daycare and also for the residential part. So it's a very, very worthwhile cause. And this project, as I say, we're trying to raise the maximum we can. So our target is to raise 100,000. And we will exceed that if we get the cooperation that we hope to get from the public for this, do you know?
Danny O'Sullivan, you've had first-hand experience with this, with your wife's passing, Alison, in October of last year, just gone. And our condolences to you as well and to your family. What was your experience of the place like?
Well, I can't speak highly of the place. Like, Alison first, she was in Cork. Sorry, she was in Tralee first. Then they brought her up to Cork, because that's where the kind of the best doctors are for cancer, really. And so Cork wasn't, it wasn't a nice place to be. So then Alison was very sick at the time, so they moved her down to the palliative care. And like the second we got there, like it was like a hotel, really. It was like, it was just, you had a big room to yourself, private room, you had a kids room, where like there was like a PlayStation where the kids could go and chill out for a while. And the staff there were just, everyone was so, what's the word now, do you know, like there was no one, everyone, if you ask them an answer, you'll always, or sorry, question, you'd always get an answer. And what I found as well good about it is that every, like, Alison was in room 14. She had the same nurses looking after her the whole time. Do you know, like, in other words, there wasn't, one nurse wasn't coming in today, then they had another nurse the next day.
That's very important.
It is.
Yeah.
So, like, the nurses had the track record the whole time of what was going on. And the most important thing is that they made her so comfortable.
Yeah.
Like, I remember the first day we got there, Patricia Sheehan came in. And Alison was, she was sick. She was barely talking, and she was just run down, like. And Patricia Sheehan, just whatever, she knew how to treat her. And within 48 hours, Alison was sitting up in the bed having conversations with us again. And that's how good they are at just managing medication. Patricia Sheehan knew exactly what to do. And like, they definitely need more beds down there.
Yeah.
Because I had a friend who, his mom was in there recently. And like, at the start, they had no beds for her. Then she was really sick, to like to bring her in. And then they were trying to send her home again, because she was stable. But like, it is a joke as well that we have to fundraise for this place. Do you know, it's mad, like.
Yeah, you think there should be more government funding, should be funded by the state.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Like, and you don't realise how important it is as well until you're actually inside the four walls. Do you know, like, I didn't know this place didn't even exist until last year. Like, when we left Cork that day, they said that we're going to the palliative care, and I actually did not know where it was.
Yeah.
I thought it was a different, like, I never knew it was connected to the hospital.
Yeah. But I suppose, Danny, to know about it, because you hope you never have to use it, but then that it's there, it's so vital into when you see it, like, yeah.
As I told you off air, it's the best place. It's the best but worst place to be.
Yeah.
If you're sick, it's the best place to be, but you don't want to be there, basically.
Yeah. I had someone close to me in there, and what struck me is the beauty of the inside of the building, and then these big windows, big doors, everything's big, and it's very comfortable and serene.
It is.
It's not like a hospital as such, you know.
It is. Like, it's very private as well. Like, all the glasses are frosted, and so no one can see in.
Yeah.
Do you know, and as you said there, you have a big room. There's an outdoor kind of balcony. There's like a place for family members to stay in the room with you.
Yeah,
it's a great place.
And they seem to have thought of everything. You mentioned kids. You know, they've thought of that side of things.
Yeah,
yeah.
They have a place just like a games room for the kids and stuff, which I think is very important, because if you have a family member in there sick, like the kids, they don't want to be in the room. They want to be like you don't want your child to be looking at your mom, dad, brother, sister. If they're sick in the bed, you know.
Yeah.
At least they can go off and take their mind off it.
Yeah, it's too intense.
Yeah.
How are you, Danny?
I'm not too bad. No, I'm just getting, like, as I taught you off air as well, it's my two kids are just getting me by. And I have great support of Alison's family. Are just, they're massive support. Like, I work in the hospital every second weekend. I work and they take my two kids. They love going back there. And I don't think I'd be able to do... I wouldn't be able to work without the help I'm getting off them. Or train. I do, like, triathlons and stuff.
Yeah.
And if I didn't have help off my family, like, I wouldn't be able to do it at all.
Yeah.
And I feel as well that, like, if you didn't have good support, you would fall into a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't draw, like, yeah. And, like, there's days that I feel like that I want to stay in bed, but I just have to get up and get on with it.
I find with grief as well, you know, having our own loss just recently enough, you know, you're kind of swept away in the whole funeral that kind of week and all that, and then it changes completely. So it's then you need the support the weeks, the months, the years after, really.
Yeah. I really hadn't time, like, I don't really sit down and think about it. You know, I'm always kind of doing something, but, like, I'm afraid that someday it is going to hit me.
Yeah.
You know, but it hasn't hit. It has hit me. It'll be a year now, in October, like, but the year has gone by just with a blink of an eye, like.
Yeah, because I'm thinking like October just gone, but yeah, when you say it like that, it's October's in the door,
11 weeks away.
Yeah. You mentioned triathlons because you look fit looking at you, though, so I was wondering about the mantle head, the mizzen head, or, you know, did you partake in that yourself, the big fundraiser?
Yeah.
You did.
Yeah, yeah.
So tell us about that. That was an amazing fundraiser again for the hospice.
Yeah, so, like, at the start, around Christmas, I asked a few of my friends. I said, "So sorry. Last year we did an Ironman, and we were going to do it last year as a training session, cycled it into the country. But then we said, you know what? It's probably 3 days away from the kids.
As a training session, sorry.
We were just going to do it, just do it, like, as in, like, just to do it last year.
I thought I misheard that.
But then we kind of said, you know what? It's 3 days. Sorry, we're going to do it in 5 days.
Yeah.
We said, like, you know, with the kids and taking off work. So then we said we'll do it this year instead.
Yeah.
Then I said to the boys at the start of the year, I said, do you know what? We'll do it. I've been trying to raise 15 grand if we can.
Yeah.
Then I asked a few of the chain gang, they're proper cyclists.
Yes,
would they do it? And a few of them boys came on board. So we had 17 cyclists the first day, and then two went away. So we had 15 the last 2 days. And it was a great experience. And the money we raised, nearly 110,000.
Yeah, it's an amazing amount of money.
Yeah.
And it was the largest figure, or the largest amount raised in a single fundraiser. So that's absolutely fantastic.
You know, I keep saying, like, I remember we were up there on Father's Day, and I said to the boys after, I would love to be at home with my two kids and my wife for Father's Day.
Yeah.
It's good to raise the money, but on hindsight, I wish I didn't have to raise the money as well. Like.
But
look, it's good that I did it. As again, I wish I didn't have to do it.
But well done. That's an amazing amount of money. And also, I think it's about the profile and even this talking about the place as well. Because sometimes with a hospice, there's a stigma attached to it as well, you know. And it's not just palliative care either, you know. You can come in and come out of the place as well. Some people think you go in and never come out.
Can I just mention as well, the nurses in the oncology ward, they were unreal as well. The second Alison was getting her chemo as well. They were all lovely, lovely people up there. You couldn't speak badly of any of them.
And that's what came into my head there when you're mentioning, you know, we're mentioning the building and we're all about fundraising for the building, but it's the staff as well. Like, they're a unique set of people, aren't they? Do you know, like you're saying, Alison had the same nurses or people dealing with her. Like a relationship has to be formed there. I know you've a professional kind of a boundaries or whatever, but it must be very difficult to actually do that. And
I've asked the nurses, I don't know, do they kind of... They kind of don't. They do get attached to patients, but they kind of have to back off as well a bit.
Yeah, do you imagine?
Like, you can't get attached because then you. Yeah. I suppose they do. There was counselling there from and stuff like.
Yeah.
So Alison was only in the palliative care for 10 weeks, but other people could be there for 6 months.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
And if you're seeing them every day as well, it's hard when they do pass away or go home.
Yeah, that's why it's almost a calling, I think, those kind of jobs, you know. You're a very special person to kind of do that, and you're kind of witnessing it now with your own job all the time as well,
people
that work in the profession. Father Brendan, it's a tough topic we're talking about here this morning, isn't it, you know?
It's
and it kind of it brings it all home, you know, why the fundraiser is important as well.
Absolutely essential, absolutely essential. And, you know, in my own experience there over the years, just going into palliative care, visiting parishioners who were in the parishes, I'd shared exactly that thing. Like, you know, that, and I had a cousin of mine who passed away in there as well. And, you know, you go in the first time wondering, my goodness, what am I facing in there? But the minute you go through that door, you sense the support and the care and the love. I mean, these people are just absolutely, in my book, saints, like, because it's not a job. It's almost a vocation, and they're helping people in a most difficult time, like, you know, and not only the person, but like, as Denny said there, like the husbands, the wives, the family and so on as well. They're wonderful people, and certainly this is a fundraiser that I certainly get 100% behind, because to think that, you know, these rooms are so badly needed. They're so badly needed. Like, this is definitely a fundraiser I would absolutely endorse 100%.
Mm. My Van Parish, how long are you there now?
Starting the second year now.
I was talking to you at the start. So how things are going? Give me a report.
Couldn't be better. Absolutely wonderful. I had 16 wonderful years in Causeway and Ballyduff. Then the call came to move on, and the bishop said to me, I'm moving you on to my van. So naturally, at the start, it's always that little bit of fear and worry, like, because I'm so used to my Ballyduff and Causeway, and so happy there. But the people have just been absolutely wonderful, and they really and truly have. The concert that Mairead mentioned there was just wonderful altogether, because it was a great way of meeting the people. So many people rode behind it. People came to you at the start and they said, look, Father Kevin McNamara, God rest him, had a few very good concerts. They're a great way of raising the funds, and I got on board with that, and the great support of the people, and that's just been the way all the way since joy. See, one of the great privileges of being a priest is when we come into a parish, often think like nobody else can do this except ourselves. Like, we can knock on doors and just say, look, I'm just visiting, just saying hello, I'm the new priest in there, and the welcome has been tremendous. The welcome has been from tremendous small age groups, so really, really happy there again.
Yeah, you've been very active, lots of things going on.
There have been a good few things going on, like not only have we had the concert, but we've going to walk through the schools as well with the children as well. There was no choir there at the start, but we now have four lovely choirs as well, and that again is just totally voluntary by people as well. So that's magnificent. It adds so much to our liturgies at the weekend as well too. So it's great to see that being developed now as well too. Like, you know, so it's fantastic. And pilgrimage, of course, being arranged as well too for the coming up in September to San Giovanni as well. So it's all great. It's all very positive.
Excellent. Well, we'll take a little break and we'll hear more from Father Brendan Walsh, Mairead Hanlon, Elaine Foley and Danny O'Sullivan after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shop and Seafood Bar, the Mall Tralee. Treat yourself to the freshest takeaway fish and chips today, right in the heart of Tralee.
Now, we're talking this morning about a wonderful fundraiser that's taking place in the Tin Thorn Theatre, Ballybunion, which is headlined by the artist Frank McNamara, and guests. They include Tomás O'Shea from Riverdance, Megan Ruby Walsh from Celtic Women, and Anne Phelan, a professional musician from Newcastle West. And it's a fundraiser for Palliative Care Hospice in Tralee. And in studio, we're joined by Father Brendan Walsh, Mairead Hanlon, Danny O'Sullivan, and Elaine Foley. Elaine Foley, tell us about your involvement over the last while in all these different events and things.
Oh Lord, as I said to Father Brendan yesterday evening, I'm the kind that I'm involved from when I think I could speak, which was probably about 5 or 6 years of age. Started the choir in my van, which Rita Gork was over at that time. Very musical family in the parish. And it kind of over the years then, my eldest sister was directing it, and Mary Kennelly, and down through the years then my sister and myself and Tara, there's like a massive group of people that have kind of passed the baton on over and over. But I suppose I was busy rearing kids, and I was living away out of Kerry at the time, and came back, and I just keep falling back into it. My daughter said to me, you need to start out to say no, Mom. Learn how to say no. But I enjoy doing it. It's nice to be involved, and it's fantastic when you get the feedback back from it. But like, I remember the concerts first starting in my van, maybe like the mid-90s, which at that time we had a wonderful priest from Ballybunion, Father Neilis Enright. And he started off kind of the first couple of concerts there. And then like that now when the priests came and went. But it's always been a great parish for to support music and support the arts. Obviously, it's a massive football village. But sometimes parishes can forget about the musical side of things, you know. But now I have to say there's some fantastic musicians, beautiful singers and performers in the parish. So it's just great to be able to kind of get involved in that. But as a parishioner, it's just lovely. Do you know when you leave a county and you come home and everything has changed, but nothing has changed?
Yeah.
You know, the priest has changed. We're blessed to have Father Brendan and obviously his predecessor, Father Brendan as well, a lovely man. But it's lovely. It brings the parish together. And you can see, you know, coming out of the church at the end of the week when there's something to look forward to.
Yeah.
And there's a plan there. Yeah. You know, so obviously we're all behind the fundraiser coming up as well, because like that, there's none of us that haven't been touched by or have had someone in the situation that have, you know, needed to avail of the services.
A choir, I think, is beautiful in a mass as well. You know, it really brings the whole thing to life. But just community involvement, you know, you hear about volunteerism slacking and, you know, people they don't have a lot of time anymore. So that's very heartening to hear, isn't it? That people, you know, are putting in the time to kind of revitalise their communities.
Oh, it is. I mean, I know myself, I've 6 children, so I know exactly how busy it can be. And it's very easy to turn around and say, oh, you know, I have the time now this evening. But when it's that getting into the car and going, it's when you come out of the church after that hour of practice. And like 9 times out of 10, we're only sniggering and giggling. Like we do very, sorry, Father, but we do very little actual singing. But it's just lovely that, you know, it's time. It's not just for it. Like people say, oh, isn't it great you volunteer to do these things? It's actually quite a selfish thing because I get something from it. Mm. You know, it's not just for who you're doing it for. But no, it's great. It's lovely to have it, and long may it last. And hopefully the younger ones coming up, you know, we'll keep it going. Like, but no, it's great. I have to say we'll keep going as long as we can anyway.
Excellent. More Aid, the fundraiser itself, tell people about it and how they can get involved or how they can support this wonderful event.
Well, I suppose the concert is on Sunday the 30th of November at the Teen Town in Ballybunnan. So we will have tickets. We have tickets printed for that already. They're €30 each. The venue will be fantastic for the type of concert that we are having. So we're doing a draw along with the concert. So we're selling tickets in the lead up to it. We have tickets available now. So we have some amazing prizes. So our first prize actually is a €3,000 voucher from JWT in Dublin for a holiday of people's choice. Our second prize is 2 nights in the Europe Hotel in Killarney and an evening meal, and that's valued at €1,400. So the third prize then, 2 nights in the Ash Hotel here in Tralee and an evening meal. Then we have 1 night in the Brehon in Killarney and an evening meal. And then the Great Southern and the Killarney, the Ahado Heights, they're giving afternoon tea for 2. So the prices are amazing. And I suppose to take this opportunity, Joe, to appeal to everybody this morning here, listening to the programme, I'll give you my number. It's 087-600-4379.
Yeah.
And I would appeal to people in the county and beyond that have availed of the services of palliative care and the hospice to please make contact and to help and support what we're doing. It's a massive fundraiser. We're very serious about what we want to raise. And if people could take a half a dozen books of tickets or 10 books of tickets to their own respective localities and sell them there, that would really help us, because if we can exceed 100,000, we will do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not going to shy away from the work that's involved, which is phenomenal. We've gone through one fundraiser already. This is going to break all records where we're concerned, you know. So we would appeal to people to make contact.
And the €30 ticket, is that for the attendance and you're entered in the draw as well, or
no,
are they separate?
The tickets,
so explain
for the draw,
that.
The tickets, yeah, for the draw are €10.
Right, perfect.
And the tickets for the concert are 30.
Yeah, okay.
Now,
the draw will be made on the night,
yeah,
then of the winners. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Out of the tickets for the concert, we have expenses.
Yeah.
The cost of the venue, the cost of the artists and all of that. But we have actually printed 10,000 tickets for the draw,
yeah,
which will realise 100,000,
yeah,
if we can sell those.
Yeah.
Now, we can always reorder,
yeah,
if the tickets sell. So I would really appeal to people, you know, the charity that it's for, you can, you know, make a huge impact.
Yeah.
and you can help people in a very difficult situation that nobody wants to find themselves in palliative care, to come out and support this by buying tickets for the concert. And I'm sure it's going to sell out very quickly. The capacity is 530 seats in the Tinthán, as against we had 800 seats in My Van Church.
Yeah.
And that was an amazing night. So I would appeal to people to buy the tickets early, because the Tinthán will sell out, and then to support our draw for the €10 tickets.
Excellent. And remind people about the artist again, Frank McNamara. I remember him now on The Late Late playing the piano. He was good crack, very talented musician, and married to Teresa Lowe. She, where in the world, in wasn't the world. That what she presented? Yeah, I think she's a very successful barrister now.
Yeah.
But so he's the main act, and then who else have you?
He is. So he has a great show. I mean, we've gone to see him twice. So the guests that he has with him for the show, you have Tomás O'Shea from Dingle, that danced with Riverdance. Then you have Megan Ruby Walsh, who was part of Celtic Women. And then there's another fantastic musician from Newcastle West, Anne Phelan. So she has played all over the world as well. So it's a really fantastic night's entertainment. And I suppose the time of year that we're having it, the 30th of November, and it's a Christmas-themed candlelit night, it's really going to be a spectacular night. And it's going to kind of set the tone for the lead-in to Christmas.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a really special night as well. And I know that everybody that will come to the concert will enjoy it.
Yeah.
Do you know?
You're the first person that's mentioned Christmas on my programme now. Can we say Christmas? Oh, we'll have to apologise for that, but it's worth it. Yeah. And Tomás O'Shea, I was wondering which Tomás O'Shea it was. Yeah. I was going to say not the footballer, but he was a very good footballer too, wasn't he?
He was
a Kerry fighter, I think.
He
yeah
was.
So yeah, an unbelievable dancer though. My god, so a really talented night. That number again is 087 600 4379. Best luck with it, Mairead. No doubt it'll be a huge success.
Thank you. And just, I suppose, on a personal note, I mean, I'm not even from the parish in My Van, but it is my adopted parish for a good number of years now. And I must say that the people up there are just amazing. And I suppose what we experienced with the last concert, that there was huge collaboration. People were there willing to come on board. The night of the concert, it was just the most amazing atmosphere to see the throngs of people coming in. And then everybody there, you had ushers, you had people doing different tasks. The GA in My Van got involved and they were manning the car park. There was no confusion. Everything was so orderly. It was just amazing how it all happened, do you know?
Yeah.
The whole logistics of it.
Excellent. Well, Mairead, lovely seeing you again. Thanks a million and well done. And best of luck with it. Lane, thanks a million for coming in. Father Brendan Walsh, I look forward to the 3-year update next year. We'll keep the reports coming, and it's great to hear such good reports about what's going on in My Van as well. And Danny, thanks a million for coming in and taking the time to come in, because I know you're a busy man and everything, and it's a tough time for you, and we're thinking of you all the time, thinking of you and your family and Alison as well. And thanks a million for paying her such a great tribute as well, and the fundraiser is absolutely amazing, so congratulations on that. So that's the My Van Parish fundraiser. Presents a Christmas themed candlelight evening with Frank McNamara and special guests, and it's on in the Tinthán in Ballybunion, and it's on Sunday the 30th of November 25. There is a Christmas theme on it as well. And thanks a million for coming in, lads.
Thank you, Joe.
Now we'll take a break, and after that we'll be hearing about Tommy O'Sullivan, the grotto builder.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry, brought to you by Quinlan's The Mad Monk in Killarney, serving the finest seafood in a cosy modern atmosphere. Book your special experience today at seafoodbar.ie.
Now, I hope you're enjoying the programme so far. Around this county and around the country, we have some wonderful grottos. They're a real feature as you wander the roads or you drive the roads of this county. There's some unique ones. One that stands out to me is in the Valencia Slate Quarry, way up high. I think my grandfather was involved in actually putting that statue, and there's a statue to the Blessed Virgin, I think it's Bernadette as well, that's there. But Tom O'Sullivan, who's no stranger to this programme, author, historian, poet and musician and everything else, he has written a wonderful piece in his book called Tommy the Grotto Builder, about Tommy O'Sullivan, Tommy Mullock from Ballyleather. And he joins me on the line now. You're very welcome, Thomas. How are you?
Thanks, Joe. Very good.
You know, Inis Dum, tell us about Tommy the Grotto Builder. How did he come across your radar? First thing.
Well, I was living in Lohurt, on the side of a hill called Knúchna Fréchán, which is the Bilvery Hill, and near Lohurt in Beaufort. And I wrote a book then called Kerry Dreamtime. And then I suppose I was asking people about the local people, the guys that had songs and poems, and came across Tommy Tomáisín Mullach O'Sullivan, and he was called the Grotto Builder. So I kind of heard about the Grotto Builder one time from the Milltown perspective. I used to see that from Listry, for anything from the northern slopes there of the McGillicuddy Reeks, I used to see a white dot on the mountainside and near Ballyleather. And I thought it was a kind of a quartz rock that was shining on the mountain. And then I noticed that sometimes during the year, it was whiter than white, and then to fade and come back again. So it was like kind of a bit of enigma. So I found out anyhow that was a grotto built by Tomáisín Mullach O'Sullivan, the Grotto Builder, sometime in the 70s. And I went to see it then when I was living close by in Lohurt. And amazing structure, really. I suppose 1,000 feet high, built by himself alone. I suppose put a bit of a, put to be maybe 15 feet high by maybe 20 something feet long, or whatever. And on the side of the mountain, the mountain called Glubba Hill, strange enough, you know. Mm. So that was the first kind of time I came across the grotto, and found out then that he made another grotto. He built another grotto in Croke Moor, which is like 3,000 feet high.
Whoa.
On his own again. So, that's amazing stuff, you know?
Hmm.
As I say, in Glubba Hill, and dedicated the Blessed Virgin, Our Lady, or whatever. And I was facing Ballyleather. And he did these grottos in dedication to his mother, who died a young woman. And he was like one-pointed, single-handedly wanted to do this part of his life. And he worked for farmers all over the place, in the bog and the hay. And they said he was as good as choices, two men or three men. And he'd go along in the evening time, and then he'd go about his business, getting cement, sand, and water, and started building the grottos. The thing about it, it was, I suppose, the Ballyleather one, let's call it a smallish one in that sense, like it was only 1,000 feet high, but for one man, just some job, you know, to bring all the hauling off the stuff on his own. He just wanted to do it on his own.
Yeah.
And the thing about it is this, people, trekkers and the reeks, I suppose they come across, and we say on the left hand side there, they're going from the Gap of Dunloe up to Strachan, up to Croke Moor, they see this grotto. Another something like we said 20, 15 feet high again, 20 feet long and maybe 5 or 6 feet wide, in a clump of stones, very solidly built, and a little small grotto in the middle of this. So just quite an amazing sight to behold in the middle of, at the top of Croke Moor, 3,000 feet high.
Yeah, and was he commissioned to do these, or what, did he just take it on his own back, like you say? So he just did it himself?
On his own, dedicated to his mother. Yeah.
That's dedicated. Beautiful, isn't it? That's a beautiful kind of reason and motivation, yeah.
Oh, right. It was like, and he worked for farmers, and it said he was as good as two or three men at the bog and the hay and the rest of it. And he'd go along his business then at evening time and do the grottos, get a few leathers and people and go down, whatever. And there was one man then that I met. He's dead now, Morris Toohey in Malis, and he knew Tommy well. Tommy would just go into Morris is a sheep farmer, and Tommy would kind of come along to the yard and say, "Hello, hello," and say, he'd always say, "Up, where you going now, Tommy?" says Morris, "Up the mountain, God's work to be done," and that was his kind of a refrain. And so one day, Tommy saw a big slab of a stone in Morris's yard, and he said to Morris, "Could I have that?" And Morris said, "Of course, yeah. Kind of what you wanted for." It was a big slab of a stone. He says, "I want to bring it up to Cook for the grotto." And Morris said, "God, you'll kill yourself doing this, Tommy." Well, he said, "Sure," he said, "with regards to the grotto, sure, if I don't do it, who will?" I thought it was an amazing answer. "Sure, if I don't do it, who will?" I mean, he was like one pint in his primary to do this, you know?
Yeah. It wasn't all success, though, Thomas. He'd kind of a mishap.
Well, he did. You see, Morris was kind of tried to look after him and tell him, "Take it easy now, Tommy. You'll kill yourself doing this." And then he wanted to do a third grotto in Carn Toole, could imagine, you know? And he was kind of testing the ground there anyhow, and he fell. I think Morris told me that time that he fell off. Not he didn't have a big fall, but he slipped somewhere along by the little ladder, injured his knee or hip or something, and that was the end of the grotto. But two grottos, two out of three ain't bad, like.
Yeah, it's not. Stay with us, Thomas, because we have to go to a break. But after that, you wrote a piece about him as well, like a poem, a piece of prose. So we want to hear that as well. But we're going to go to break with him more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across the county. Serving the freshest seafood to Kerry families since 1963.
Hi, we'd love you to join us at the Kmart's Traditional Folk Academy this year.
We learn Irish dancing, sing Irish songs and do loads of fun folk drama. It's great crack.
We're now enrolling for September classes in Killarney, Tralee, Dingle and Fanoog.
Come along and join us this year.
Visit ceim-arts.ie.
The all-new Volkswagen Transporter van has arrived at Devan's Castle Island. Available in short to long, basic to high spec, two-wheel drive to the mighty 4Motion, and also comes with a five-star offer. 5-year warranty, 5-year service plan, and exclusive to Devan's up to €5,000 scrappage. Terms and conditions apply. Call in and view it for yourself with our experienced commercial specialists happy to assist you. Devan's, your authorised Volkswagen dealer.
New this week in Home Store and More. All home office desks and chairs are all half price. But better hurry, because when all our half price home office desks and chairs are gone, they're gone. Also, all toilet seats are still all 33% off, and all pet beds, toys and accessories are still all half price. But when all the 33% off toilet seats and all the half price pet beds, toys and accessories are gone, they're definitely gone. Drop by your local Home Store and More. Visit us online at homestoreandmore.ie. Home Store and More. A happy home.
The sun is out and summer savings are adding up with Super Value. Fire up the barbecue with our 3 for €10 meats like sausages. Scan your Real Rewards card or app and make great savings like €1.50 for our 4-pack Yop range and €2.75 each for Kellogg Cereals Big Packs, giving you more change in your pocket. Super Value. Real savings. Real difference.
Flying from Cork Airport this autumn? Travel seamlessly with Cork International Hotel's Stay, Park and Fly package. Relax in style the night before, leave your car safely with us and enjoy a complimentary airport shuttle to and from Cork Airport. Perfect for Kerry holidaymakers heading abroad. Book now at corkinternationalhotel.com.
You're listening to the Saturday Supplement with Joe McGill on Radio Kerry.
You're listening to the Saturday Supplement. I'm Joe McGill. We're talking about Tommy the Grotto Builder, or Tommy Tomashin Mullock from Ballyleather. And we were talking just before the break, Thomas, about his final attempt to build a grotto on Carn Toole. And I was thinking, you know, when you were telling me this story during the week about, you know, there's the Stations of the Cross going up Canuck and the Dubber, and the effort it would have taken, like, to bring the sand and cement. Now, I presume there was a few at that. Like, so he was an amazing man to be able to do this all on his own. And he obviously had a wonderful personality to match, you know, that he was doing this in dedication to his mother.
Well, I suppose he's like single. He wanted to do it on his own for his mother, and it was his life's work in one sense. And he, well, Woe fought, as we know, like you were asking there about Chenera and Belly Leather and all these places. That was called the old parish of Tua. That was the old local name for Tua. And he faced the Belly Leather grotto and the Crookmore facing down Belly Leather, his mother's people, you know?
Yeah.
So, and he wanted to do Cairn Toul as well, but with the mishap in that, you know?
Yeah, you've written a wonderful piece, the story of him, but also a poem. Would you recite a bit of it? I know it's probably too long to do it all, but, you know, the parts you want to do.
Yeah, well, it's just a little bit there. There's a refrain there. It says, up the mountain, God's work to be done. Sure, if I don't do it, who will? So that's the refrain. So the first bit is there. A dialect of bog, hay and sheep, overtones of furs, heather and haw, raven, stoat and hare harmonious, a symphony for Tua. Bleating sheep, howling wind, rain scudding from the west, befriend shrouds of fog in the hollows along the footholds. The foothills of Tua, up the mountain, God's work to be done. Sure, if I don't do it, who will? That's a little extract.
Excellent. Oh, it's wonderfully written, Thomas. Well done. I'm just seeing here there's a quote you've in the piece as well from Donny Foley. It was said, in order to survive in the Reeks, you need to have a good wife, good neighbours, a good dog, and good weather. Now, I would say that's not only to survive on the Reeks, that's to survive a life, you could say that.
Well, that's true. And Donny died a couple of years ago as well. A gas man, really, I must say, meant for sheep and stuff. And that was his quote. I thought it was amazing, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Tomás Sheen himself, he passed away in February 2000.
He did, yeah. And he died in the St. Finan's Mental Hospital. The straw took the camel back was he was living in a caravan in Belly Leather, and the storm came and his caravan was wrecked, and I suppose that was the straw, and he was brought to St. Finan's Hospital and he died there. So sad enough in that sense. But there was a man then a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about Canuck na Dover or whatever, the last week of July, Davy Lean, a bit of his brainchild, he said, we'll have to do something for Tomás Sheen, and that he knew that in 1975 he completed the Crookmore Grotto, and he said, we'll have to do a bit of a 50th anniversary. So Davy got a couple of us together, and John Cronin and Esther, and we had a kind of a nice little gathering there underneath Crookmore, and it was kind of splendid and sunshine or whatever. And we had a few music and songs and this and that, blessings and Benachty, etc. And a bit of a Blurini Blaster at a Cronin restaurant, John Cronin's restaurant. So it was a nice kind of a humble kind of a gathering of local people from Tua. And it was a great thing to kind of mark that there was a relation of Tommy's there. And the interesting thing, when I was doing the book, I trawled Beaufort and around, look for a photograph of Tommy. There was no photograph, but lo and behold, John Cronin found a photograph, a side face of Tommy in somewhere, and he unveiled that the night of the 50th anniversary. The interesting thing about, you were talking to Canuck na Dover and Drumhill, it was the eve, we call it, of Lunasa, and which was the mountain gatherings there, like in Drumhill or whatever. And it was very coincidental that we had it for Tommy, the grotto builder, around the eve of Lunasa, yeah.
Oh, wow. His grottos, do they still stand?
Yep. Absolutely. Davy was telling me that there was some lightning or something struck at some stage and it kind of displaced some of the stones, and then went along with steel bars and they sorted out. So he's going to be there for kingdom come.
That's brilliant. They stand as a testament to him and to his mother as well. And Thomas, you have captured his story wonderfully as well. So thanks a million for that. And thanks a million for coming on this morning.
Welcome, Father. Okay.
That is Thomas O'Sullivan there, and what a wonderful story, and it's brilliant that it's captured and put down in print as well. We're going to take a break for the news at 10, and join me in the next hour where we'll be hearing from the late Mick McGillicuddy from Over the Water in Carsovine about his life as a fisherman. Never heard before interview that I did back in 2020. So we'll be listening to that after the news at 10. I'll join you again in the next hour.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry, brought to you by the new family fish box at Quinlan's Seafood Bars, packed with golden fish goujons, fresh squid, delicious prawns and tasty homemade chips. Order yours to take away today.
We're into the second hour of the Saturday Supplement, and I hope you're enjoying the programme this morning. I'm Joe McGill. I'll be with you till 11 o'clock. A few years ago now, back in 2020, in January 2020, I was invited by Dermot McGillicuddy, who is the son of Mick McGillicuddy, or Mick Mac, as he was affectionately known as, to interview him about his life as a fisherman. He was ill at the time and he passed away a few months later. This was January 2020. He passed away in June 2020. If you'll remember, in that time period, say after January into March, the world was turned upside down with COVID. So I did an interview with him about his life as a fisherman, and I'm delighted that I got the opportunity to record some of his stories. So we're going to have a listen to that now over the next half an hour or so. I'm here over the water and I'm in the house of Mick McGillicuddy, a fisherman for many years, so I can't wait to hear his tales. His accent is South Kerry, but there's also Donegal in it, and we'll find out why that is. But firstly, Mick, thanks a million for welcoming me to your home.
Not at all, but not at all.
Tell us, where exactly are we?
We are in, I suppose, Kimago West would be our address here, between Kimago West and Tourmoor. You know, I think the river going down there is the borderline of them.
Okay.
So several letters would come with both kind of our letters at different, you know, addresses there, but kind of the same thing, yeah.
There's a famous kind of a pier down here and a place where I used to learn. That's where I learned how to swim.
Yeah. Cuscrom there, yeah. Oh, sure. When I was young, we usedn't get time to go near because we used to have an awful lot of crops for sale and everything. And different stuff like that every year. And all, I suppose, work, hand stuff. And I wouldn't get a chance to go near the strand, like,
yeah,
because you're working all the time. I mean, I used to kill myself working to get days off from school because I cursed every day I ever went to school.
So what was your father? What was your father? He was a farmer, is it?
Farmer. Because we used to, I mean, all our fields up there now, there'd be at least maybe three fields in all of them years ago, and be out till dark at night trying to make drains and everything and knock those fences, and all by shovel, all manual labour like. And it was hard work because I used to kill myself working to get days maybe off from school. You know, different things are, you know, go different places like. But it was a rough scene.
We're here, well, we can't see it now because it's dark, but the sea is just out here. Was the sea always kind of calling to you? Were you looking out at it with kind of a sense of adventure, or did you want to be on it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because all the days I used to see all the boats, dingle boats, were fishing out there up and down every evening. And they were bringing in a lot of fish that time. I mean, I had a brother, or no, first cousin, John Connor. You would probably know him. He was fishing with Mike Murt that time. They'd be lobster fishing, more or less. But Christy Shea, then he'd be purse. He was seining that time. That was a different kind of fishing altogether.
Describe that now for people that wouldn't know, because there'll be people listening to this and they won't know what that is.
Well, I think the seine fishing, there was so much of it years ago that was gone away from the pint in the train floats.
Mm.
And all the guys that sold that fish were getting big money for it in Dublin, because it was given away to all the army guys and naval guys to harden them up for all that stuff.
And that would have been mackerel, probably, I'd imagine.
Mackerel, yeah. All mackerel, mackerel, yeah.
So you were looking out at them, almost envious that you wanted to be out there yourself.
Yeah, that's right. I suppose I got the chance to work at the pint then. Oh, yeah, I went to the pint to work. I suppose I gave 3 years at the pint before I went away on the 6th of March, I suppose.
What age were you then in the pint?
I would have been coming up around, maybe it'd be around the 20 years sometime.
Hmm.
I suppose I wanted to go fishing, like, anyway, you know.
Mm. You were saying to me before we started, so, and just for people that would know, the pint is in Renard, so there would have been a fish factory there, you know, overlooking Valentia.
Yeah.
But your father didn't want you to go to sea.
No.
And he didn't want you leaving because he wanted you here, in other words.
That's right, for farming.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, that's what I was brought up to. But looking out at that bay, I had other ideas.
It was calling you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you remember the day you left?
Well, I suppose I would when I kind of, I had a car that I'm going to the pint, like, and I left everything behind me. My father didn't think I'd go away, like, that way, but I was seasick for a long, long time.
Were you? Yeah. So why did you, where did you go first? Donegal, was it straight? Or where did you go first?
No, we were around the south of Ireland for a long time.
Right.
And I remember I was very bad with seasickness. I remember, I think there was one trip I couldn't get up at all. It would be an old boat, and up further, and it would be a very cold old place. But I was seasick. I mean, I came in every time, but I still wouldn't give in to it. And I kept going at it till I kind of got over it. But it took a long time.
Did it?
I did, yeah. It took a long time.
Who owned those boats?
I was kind of with Joe Shea. Then I think Joe Shea had got his first boat. And I suppose I kind of promised him, I was away at that time, I was up around Dublin, I think, and I kind of promised I'd come back to him. But I gave a few years with him, and then one time we were away up off Cleggan, in there one time for a, it was a very bad night. And I met guys from around Dublin and every place. They all knew me from the East Coast before that. And this guy came over to me and he says, hey, Mac, do you want to bet with these guys? They're getting two new boats built in Holland. And I says, yeah, no problem. That was big stuff to be asked to go on. Those big boats, they were, you know, stern trawlers, and they'd be very big ponds in them that time for, they'd be very broad and big ponds in them for holding fish, you know. So we got over to Holland anyway, and down to the boats and staying in a hotel, drinking every night, and down around the boats every day, seeing how things were going. And next thing I thought, this money we were getting was just a sub, like. And first thing I went on, next thing I found out, oh, this was no sub. We were getting this every day for drinking and living it up and into Amsterdam every weekend. And so it was, as they say, the first time we seen money.
Mm. And you were in your 20s probably, is it, at this stage? You would have been a young man.
I would, I would. But that was interesting stuff.
Mm, I can imagine. And what were you fishing for that time?
We'd be fishing for fight fish that time. There was one summer or one winter after we came back from Holland that time. That was the biggest cod fishing that was ever seen in Donegal. We used to have one man repairing nets every night ashore. There was times that you would mark the cod, big spots of them, and maybe tow for maybe 10 minutes, and you had 200 or 300 boxes of big cod. Mm. I tell you, your arms from trying to gut them and cut the heads off them to try and put them into boxes. It was hard work, like.
Yeah.
It was hard work. But, like, we were making money, all right, but, geez, you worked hard.
You worked hard.
Yeah.
And a very dangerous job.
Well, it wasn't dangerous. We got used to fishing. You didn't call it dangerous.
Yeah.
Like, because you got used to a system and that's what it was. But, oh, there was danger in it, I suppose, but we didn't look at that part of it.
Yeah. But you needed people to carry their weight or there would be danger. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's the thing as well. Yeah. Oh, yes. But it was a scene you got used to when we made money there, all right, that time, boy.
Mm.
I mean, that time I remember we came fight fishing down as far as Galway the next spring. And good, lively place to be as well. So we had plenty of company around there times. But we used to finish up every Thursday night and we wouldn't be going out till Sunday night again.
Right.
So that was our week's fishing. And, I mean, you were making good money there. I mean, we were making £500 or £600 a week that time.
And what years we talk? Is the 70s or when was that?
That's the start of the 70s, yeah.
My God, that much a week?
Yeah.
So you lived hard and played hard then, I'd imagine, when you'd hit Galway for a few nights.
Oh, well, yeah. You had plenty of company about, yeah. But, that was true, yeah.
Yeah, the late Mick McGillicuddy there, and we're going to be hearing more of his story after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Enjoy a simple, healthy and easy dinner solution with Quinlan's fresh, ready-made seafood meals. Available in store.
Now let's return to the interview I did with Mick McGillicuddy, a fisherman from over the water who passed away in 2020, and I did this interview a few months before his passing. Just as a timeline so that I understand, you went from South Kerry, you were fishing here in South Kerry, then you went to Holland, I presume, and then to Donegal, is it?
Yeah.
Is that the way it worked? And then you were fishing out of Donegal, that's how you'd come down to Galway.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
And how many would be in a crew with you?
There'd be, I suppose, 7 or 8 of us. You had an engineer, like you had an engineer in each boat, 2 big fight stern trawlers, like, and you had a mate as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that was 2.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a crew, I suppose, of maybe 6 or 7, like, you know, you'd kind of fair sized crew because, well, you worked fairly hard, like.
Yeah. And what was your job? So describe for someone that had never been on a boat before what you would do when you were fishing there at that time.
Well, I think you never thought of it that way, like, because it was something that
came natural.
Natural, yeah. Yeah. It came natural to you, like, that's the way it was. But
were you ever out rough nights?
Oh, you were. We've seen a lot of rough nights because there was long Lincoln boats then, other different boats. And, like, the winter was our main time for fishing. So, and them Lincoln boats, I tell you, if you've seen the state of them times. And, well, I suppose one night especially, we were one of the worst nights we ever seen. We came down inside the Hebrides, you know, and I remember I got up sometime in the morning anyway, and I just, Christ, I thought, this is a very nice day. And it was then when I got up and looked around, I seen, looked out at the portholes of the deck of the boat. They could see nothing, only water. I mean, the whole deck of her was full. And she was going down gradually, slowly. And you'd be hoping that no doors or windows gave away up in the whaleback of her. You know, there was a closed whaleback in her.
Yeah.
And that was all right, he says. I remember he seeing the forecast the night before, and he says, we'll get down in the eye of this. Like, I mean, he put us out next day, but there's no one could go down in the deck of the boat. There was a heap of stuff, all damaged, all these chutes that you leave your fish into, an awful lot of them damaged and stuff hanging over the side. But you couldn't go down in the deck of her. That was a
scary
trip now.
Yeah, and what, you just rode it out, is it?
Well, you just had, you know a place to go. Like, if that boat, oh, shoot, and you couldn't see anything out through the windows by blowing sea. Nothing at all. Because you just hope she was going to, you know, keep going.
Yeah.
But that was a scary time. You just hoped she was going to make it into Lough Swilly.
Yeah. How far out used you go? From Donegal, no, for instance.
Oh, sure. We used to go way up, I suppose, off. You were going away north of Scotland that time, fishing, like, you know.
Really?
Yeah, up off Shetlands and things. You were going away north for fish that time, like, because the winter fishing was the fishing mackerel.
Winter time?
Yeah, the winter time. Bad weather, like, time. Yeah.
And cold. And you'd be gone for days on end, so.
Oh, yeah. There was times we wouldn't be back for a few months, like, 2 or 3 months, I think. There was times we left them boats in Norway. Different times we flew home, like, for a few days at Christmas. It would be only a few days because you get a plane back again.
And what would you do with the fish that you were catching? You were processing it yourselves on board, is it? Putting it in salt, or what were you doing?
No. You were landing it to Norwegians.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
And back out to sea.
Yeah.
That must have been tough for a young family, was it?
It was a tough scene, definitely. Yeah. My wife had a tough time, like. But I think they kind of get you, only for she was around home, I suppose, and she had a family to help her a lot. Mm. That kept her, and, you know, what we say, otherwise, you know, you'd kind of crack up, like.
Mm. Where did you live in Donegal? What was it called?
It would be a small village called Kilcar. Yeah.
And describe what that looks like, because people often say that Donegal looks a bit like Kerry. So was it similar, or what did it look like?
It was kind of similar as well, but you couldn't see the bay from where we lived in Kilcar, like. But you could, I suppose, go out the road further, and you had a good view there of you heard of the highest cliffs there in Europe, like out by Slieve Lake and that way, you know.
You must have seen some beautiful spots out when you were fishing too on calm days, I'd imagine.
Oh, you did, and calm days as well. Like, but you know, the winter time was your time most of the time, you know.
And did you have time to look at it, or were you just work?
I think you got used to it. It was part of your system, like, you know. And I think you got used to what you were at, and that was the way it went, you know. But it was an interesting lifestyle, like a mad lifestyle. I mean, if you've seen the drinking and everything that we used to do, you were brought up to it. We were one of the most nameless boats in the west of Europe, because any place we ever went into, there'd be a huge drinking session while we'd be landing fish. And they always seemed to like to see us coming again, because there'd be some money spent. But it was mad lifestyle, like. But the work was number one, though.
Yeah.
You had to get up after 2 hours or anything, and we'd a skipper that he'd take her out to harbours there, and that man could be rotten. And when he'd get out anyway, take her out, and he'd say, okay, if you see fish, call me. And once you said you'd seen fish, to him, he was up like a shot. So he was the most luckiest guy with fishing that I ever seen. And he taught all these other guys as well, because he's seen or roamed all the coasts of Ireland with an old whitefish boat that was leaking years before that. And he taught all of them how to fish. And a lot of them wouldn't take up the ends of the boat because it was too dangerous to shore. He knew all the shoreline.
Yeah. And like, was that his knowledge of the sea?
That was his knowledge. And he was lucky as hell. We often went to ground places, but he was lucky. He could get away with anything. Leave the other boats go out, and they'd have to come back again. No fish going. Like, you talk about a man with luck on his side. You know, he'd never get the likes of him.
Yeah.
You know, one of those. But he was keen at his job.
Yeah.
Mick McGillicuddy there, and we're going to hear more from Mick after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across Kerry. Take the fear out of fish and chat to our fishmongers about how to add delicious, easy-to-cook seafood into your menu. Oven and air fryer-ready meals available.
Let's return to the interview I did with the late Mick McGillicuddy about his life as a fisherman. The one thing I noticed when I met you, Mick, was your tattoos. And you had tattoos now when people around know every second teenager has a tattoo now. But you had tattoos when no one had tattoos. And what did they symbolise?
Well, in Dublin that time, you know, those people got tattoos for the crack, and some of them wouldn't get them finished, you know.
Yeah.
Like, they are, you'd have to put up with, it goes into the flesh, like, you know. Mm-hmm. But some of them never got them finished. But I think you have to grin and bear it, like, you know. But I think it kind of considered you a kind of a harder guy, more or less.
A rite of passage.
Yeah, yeah. It was something that something that most of these guys done.
This tattoo is a tattoo of a ship?
It's supposed to be a sinking ship.
Okay. And why did you pick that one?
I thought, I'm trying to think now.
But I wonder, was it superstitious?
And it was, there was more thinking to this one.
Yeah.
Like, to supposed to be hope across an anchor, sinking ship.
Mm.
So,
and did the rest of the lads have tattoos?
Yeah, the most of them had, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, the nearly.
It's kind of a fisherman thing, isn't it?
It was a kind of a thing about fishermen, yeah.
Getting back to the fishing, during the summer, you know, you're going, winter time is when you're really making hay while the sun shines out at sea. What would you do during the summer then?
Oh, I'd be down here on holidays.
Would you?
All my family would be down every summer. So, like, they'd be in Jai down here, like, say, Dermot. He got carried away here. He stayed here. And, like, there was five more of them. They'd be mad to be down here in the summer, like.
Yeah. How many kids have you?
Six.
Six.
Yeah.
And did you like coming down here?
Oh, I did. I did for the change, like, yeah. Oh, yeah, because what they used like to come down, it was different to them, like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where was the farthest you ever went fishing?
Oh, the farthest would be way up. I suppose off Greenland.
Really?
Yeah, because we were fishing fishing blue whiting for. It was for food that time, way up there. And there was five or six boats of us working together. And we saw fill them up before we'd steam back to we'd come back to the Faroe Islands, I think, to land. And when we were full, we used to land there. And we'd head away then again and fill them all up, do the same thing again. So you were way up off Greenland, more or less, that time.
Mm.
You were way, I mean, you know, you had brightness in the day, like, it was the sunshine all around, like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah,
of course, they're the almost 24/7, yeah. And would you see other boats when you're out fishing now, or was there sparse areas of just ye?
Well, I think up there you didn't see that many. You've seen ships and different things because you've a vast heap of water away to the north there, like, you know.
Mm.
You have a massive sea of water, like. But you'd see ships and things and different things. But
any wildlife? Any whales?
Well, oh yeah, you'd see whales. Jesus, the whales used to come up alongside us when we were fishing mackerel. Oh, we weren't scared them off by. they come up the side of the boat after mackerel. Oh, yeah. The whales, the killer whales, like.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The black with the white.
Yeah. Oh, the killer whales. Jesus, they take them out of your hand, but you wouldn't give them your hand.
They were impressive, I'd say, though.
Oh, they were, yeah. Like, I mean, yeah. Oh, they were around you all the time once they've seen fish, like. You take no notice, when you used to it all the time, you know.
Mm. Did you enjoy fishing?
Oh, I did.
Mm.
I did because, look, we were making good money at it. And that was the name of the game, you know. I mean, I suppose there was no other ones making money like it, you know.
But it strikes me you have to be tough in the head. You have to be tough mentally to do that job.
I think you don't think of it that way.
Mm.
You think of it and now you're talking about a job and you're getting well paid for it.
Mm.
You know, I think that's the way it sinks into us, you know.
Mm. And how did you come back here then?
I finished, I gave 40 years fishing in in 08. Yeah, I gave him 40 years fishing.
When you came back here, did you go fishing just yourself all around here?
No. Like, there's a couple of guys at pot fishing there, and I suppose trying to fish for crab and three or four different things. Alex Crowley, yeah. But it's a tough bloody job, two of them. Like, it's a tough job. Like,
fishing from the height of the 70s to now is completely different, isn't it?
Completely. We have no fish now. I mean, I remember one scene down at Drinard Point. I think before I went away, I used to always talk to foreigners, like, if they were in. But there was these Norwegians in there one time, and got talking to them. And they opened up a big hatch, which was layered with big, huge fish, big halibut, big turbot, brill. You talk about size of fish. And this is the best place we ever came to fish, says.
Yeah, the fascinating life story there of Mick McGillicuddy, or Mick Mac, as he was affectionately known as, who passed away in 2020. And I got to interview him a few months before that about his life as a fisherman and the wonderful stories involved there. And I want to thank Dermot, his son, for inviting me over to the house that evening to record Mick, and to thank Mick as well for welcoming me in. May he rest in peace. And now, I suppose, to give us more context and to find out a bit more about Mick, the man himself, I'm joined by a colleague of his that fished with him for almost two decades, more than 17 years, Rory McNeilis from Donegal. Rory, you're very welcome to the programme. It's 5 years now since Mick's passing, but you knew him very, very well, when we say 17 years. And you know, you're almost in each other's pockets when you're fishing. There isn't many places to avoid each other anyway on a boat.
Yeah. I Mick, when I came on the boat first, of course Mick was very welcoming, you know.
Mm.
He's a lovely man, really, really nice man. And he would have been a bit older than me, but we clicked straight away. Jesus, he was a lovely personality.
Mm.
And he was just a nice human being, because everywhere we went, you could be sure that he would be one of the first people who was introduced himself to the locals, you know.
Mm.
Got to know the locals, and he was a great man for socialising, and he would want to know what, as he called himself, where the action was. And he would find out what was on before anybody else would know, when he would come back with the information, so we would know where to head. So there's some great stories about him, and one of the first that I remember myself, probably the first year I was in the boat, and I was only getting to know the lads, and we landed in a loch in the north of the Shetland Islands in bad weather.
Yeah.
And we were just on the boat. You were going to pass a few days in the boat. We could see a few houses, maybe three houses, but it was really wild terrain. And the boys, after the second day, the lads were a bit fed up on the boat, so I convinced one of the lads to take him in on the launch to the shore.
Yeah.
And he was going up and investigate and visit one of the houses and see what was the story. And away he went. And I was watching him through the glasses from the boat. And just as he was coming close to the house, if you move about 5 miles from the shore, a lady came out to put some clothes on the line. And I was thinking to myself, this man's going to walk up behind her and tap her on the shoulder. But he must have called her. He didn't want to frighten her, and he called her. And it turned out that her husband was a fisherman as well. Down, the boat would be based further south in Lerwick in the Shetlands.
Yeah.
And we knew him from sort of drinking, socialising down there.
It's a small world.
He was away fishing at the time.
Mm.
But they were based down in Lerwick, and he was, once he heard, she got in touch with them, and he heard we were up there. So that night, we're all invited up to the house for a party. And there's four boats of us in the loch at the time. And every one of them launched, put out their launches and put men up in the shore. The house was filled that night. But there was a pub that we couldn't be from where we were.
Yeah.
There was a pub 3 miles away. So the fisherman, well, I think, I'm not sure what his name was, Rob Evers, he organised a minibus from his house and took everybody to the pump first and then ended up back at the house for more drinks and back out to the boat during the night sometime. But we went away the next day then and that was a bit. But he was a great man for finding out what was going on, you know.
Yeah, but it's a great ability to have, to be able to, you know, be able to talk to strangers and meet strangers, because that's what makes life experiences, is meeting other people and talking to other people. And he seemed to be great at that. I used to meet him in the Baron Chahili's in Carhartt-Sivean, and he was very, very sociable. And what I noticed when I talked to him during the interview about it was his tattoos in his arms, you know, because when you wouldn't see a lot of tattoos back then. But a very sociable man. That's such a great character trait to have, isn't it?
Oh, and he was very forward in his dressing as well. He liked his leather gear and his flashy shirts, and you know, he had a lot going for him.
And do you know what strikes me as well from the interview is a very kind of, I suppose, a steely character, you know, tough as nails, and needed that for the profession you were in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, there were plenty of tough times. You had to be tough. And I mean, he was just a lovely, soft, gentle man, but you wouldn't be taking the hand of him or anything, you know?
Mm.
No, not at all. He would be wise. He'd be streetwise for sure, you know?
Mm.
And then he had a lovely family too. And, well, later on, when I got to know them, whenever the boys would be driving around, maybe he was having a few pints in town or something, and the boys would be taking him here and there. They were lovely boys, lovely family, and the two girls as well, really nice.
Mm.
I got to know them all later on, and I've kept in touch with them since, you know, since Mick passed away.
Mm. You've become like I'd imagine you're like a second family when you're away, because you're away for massive amounts of time at a time. Yeah.
For sure. And I was actually the cook on the boat, and Mick was one of the easiest people that you ever have to cook for, because he would eat anything and there was nothing went to waste.
Yeah.
Even at night when they would come down from the pub or something, he would go and have a look in the fridge, and you would often see Mick walking around the boat chewing a bone. And the last pieces off with ours, there was nothing to waste now.
Yeah, but I suppose like a lot of people in rural Kerry and rural Ireland, you know, when you're growing up, there isn't a lot to be had, so you don't take it for granted when you get it.
Absolutely, yeah, that's right.
Mm.
No, he was a lovely man to be around, you know, and to work with. So we would have been away at times for 12 weeks. I remember doing 12 weeks, and at the time it's, you know, it was, we joined families.
Mm.
And we didn't have communications like we have now.
Mm.
And you'd be, and especially when we were fishing out in Norway, because you'd land, that the factories were in isolated places because we were giving the community work. And the phone, if the people in the factory allowed you to use the phone, it was great. Otherwise, we only had the satellite phone on the boat, which was very expensive.
Mm.
At the time, I think it was something like 5-6 euros a minute,
mm.
It was only used in emergencies.
Mm.
So you needed to get a hotel, because the pubs didn't have phones. A hotel would have a phone, and some bigger towns maybe would have a kiosk, especially in the fishing towns. They would have kiosks for fishermen, you know.
Yeah.
And that would be your way. But when you had two or three boats coming in there or something, where there'd be a queue at the kiosk. There were more important things to be doing maybe than queuing up.
Yeah, yeah, my God. I can picture the scene. And do you know another thing that struck me about the interview with Mick? Like, we often hear about shellfish, you know, eat it with an hour in the month, you know, that's kind of the time. But it was very much the winter time you were fishing as well, which is not an ideal time to be out in the water, you know. It's tough, tough conditions out there.
Yeah. Oh, no, we went to plant bad weather, absolutely, because what was happening, if you did have a spell of 12 hours even of good weather, then you had to go in bad weather and you'd come back in bad weather.
Mm.
But the only time the weather was good when you were fishing, which was important, of course, but you still had to leave and be there for the good weather.
Mm.
And then go through the storm on the way back to port, you know.
Mm.
But luckily enough, when we were fishing out in Norway, we weren't that far from shore ever.
Yes.
20 hours maximum, you know.
Hmm. How did you pass the time in the boat when you weren't kind of working?
Well, we would have played cards.
Yeah.
And Mick would have played as well. Mick would have played. We were playing K21. We played a bit of poker, but not a lot, you know.
Yeah.
But no, cards was the main pastime. Mick would have read. We would have read a bit too, you know.
Yeah.
Would have been, yeah.
Are you still fishing, Rory?
I am indeed, but this is very limited now.
Yeah.
Very, very limited. Last year, actually, I only fished for 35 days in the whole year.
Whoa.
That's hard to believe, because we wouldn't have even, in Mick time, we wouldn't have even had 35 days off in summer.
Yeah.
Around that, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
Not much. And that was just for tidying up the boats and getting some maintenance done, you know.
Hmm. It's a completely different world now, fishing.
Yeah.
Just the final thoughts, I suppose, on Mick. It's great to capture someone, you know, and record someone, because, you know, usually you don't get to interview, I think, a lot of interesting people about their lives, because they don't make a big song and dance about it. You know, Mick just got on with things. So it was great that Dermot invited me over to record his story, but his memories live on in his family and by the likes of yourself as well.
Yeah, always very highly thought of in Killybegs and Kilcar. Very highly thought of. People missed him so much. But when he moved back to Kerry, he was missed, you know.
Mm.
But we would still be able to be in touch with him, you know, when we went to see him when he was ill, which was, it was very tough. It was one of the toughest things I ever had to do, I'd say, is would to leave Mick that day, knowing that I was never going to speak to him again or never see him alive again, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because he just wasn't in great form, even for a phone call at the time, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm really surprised it was after that that you did the interview with him, you know.
Yeah, I did it in January 2020, yeah. And to think the world was turned upside down then. Rory, thanks a million for coming on and talking about Mick and paying tribute to him in such a beautiful and personal way. But thanks for taking the time to talk to me this morning.
Oh, that's fine, Joe. Thank you very much for chatting.
We're going to take a break. We'll have more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Supplement your diet with a healthy and fresh dinner option. Fresh seafood from Quinlan.
Now, a reminder of our monthly In Focus photography slot, the first Saturday of every month with Dominic Walsh. And we invite you at home to send in your photos for the month, and this month's theme, we always give you a theme to kind of motivate you and to focus the mind. It's August time in Kerry. That's August time in Kerry. So whatever reminds you of August time in the kingdom, that's what we want you to send us in, and send the stories that goes along with them as well. And remember, Pop Fair is just gone, the Rose is on at the moment. It could be maybe, you know, the green and gold that was around the county. Whatever it is that reminds you of August time in Kerry, email them to jmcgill@radiokerry.ie before midday Wednesday, before the first Saturday of the month. Now, that's all we have time for on the programme this morning. Thanks a million for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the programme and for keeping me company over the last few hours. Niamh Daly is filling in for Frances, so she's up next. So keep it here on Radio Kerry. My thanks to Abigail Bernard, who was on sound. I'll be back again next Saturday from 9 a.m. Until then, look after yourself and take care.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across Kerry. Because at least one day of the weekend should involve someone else doing all the cooking. Order your delicious takeaway from Quinlan's today.